50, whatever it is, and then finally getting to the first test, the actual soil test. So, I think it's doing well. And we'll look forward to the science from curiosity for the next 2 years after Glen Egg, they call it, that's where three geological features come together. And they're going to analyze different areas. They know that's an interesting thing because they know water was running at one time. And they have three different geological areas in one. And a bit of a gold mine. And then after that, they'll go up to Mount Sharp, a big mountain in the background, 3 mile high mountain. And they'll investigate that. Probably where it's pure stuff. Get opportunity. I think he's still riding around. That rover's been up there since 2004. And Spirit has quit a long time ago, a couple of marches ago. But, you know, opportunity's still sending back good science. So much for curiosity. I wanted to mention that you have another crew going up to the International Space Station. There's three on board now. And they'll be joined by three more launched from Kazakhstan on a Soyuz spacecraft October 23rd. Another thing I wanted to mention is NASA's always looking for new things to do. Drop it. US2N. One of the proposals that they're getting actually, they were going to get this in the beginning of the year, but they're starting to put together information about it now, is they want to put eventually a new space station up, but not in Earth orbit. Long-range plans. It'll be a place for the Orion spacecraft, which is being built by NASA. You know, in 2017, they'll be launching people on this thing. And they plan to go to eventually asteroids, Mars, maybe the Moon. One of the places they'd like to go to, which would be very far away from the International Space Station, is another space station at the L2 position, Lagrange Point 2, Earth-Moon. If you know what that is, there's five different areas, five Lagrange points. Well, two happens to be behind the moon, which happens. They'd like to set a space station. That would be, as far as Earth is concerned, always almost out of sight, really. It'll be on the opposite side of the moon. So talk about something being, you know, in the way of something else. I mean, this is a long-range plan, but they're now considering this. And it would be a good place to send Orion to. You'd be able to launch this thing, and, you know, 3-4 days later, eventually it would get there and dock with the space station behind the moon. What good would it be? Well, they've never landed a manned vehicle, or, for that matter, an unmanned vehicle successfully on the far side of the moon. So what they'd like to do is land vehicles, rovers, things of that nature, and actually have them controlled by astronauts aboard a space station at the L2 position. That's one of the things they'd like to do. So I thought I'd bring that up because it's kind of outrageous, but that's what we do here on the net. Let me drop it. One other thing from the International Space Station. There's a company that wants to, or they are not doing it. Wants to put a permanent camera on board the space station, looking down at Earth. And, you know, it would zoom in, and it would always be looking, you know, a real tight look, similar to Google Earth, except live on the International Space Station. You would be able to go to a website and bring up the camera and see International Space Station is looking at the time, except across the building. It had this thing zoomed all the way in. So if it's over Russia, let's say, you'd be able to look down and maybe see the Kremlin go by. So another thing from the International Space Station. We've been talking a lot about the commercial vehicles going up. There is one company that I haven't talked much about. I've mentioned half a dozen or so that are really in the running. This one here is one I haven't really mentioned that much. It's called Origin. This company is set up by Amazon.com. The owner of Amazon is involved with this project. And he's now got hardware working. Testing rockets, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen rockets. All the other companies are putting out rockets that are made from kerosene and liquid oxygen. This is a new liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen model. Travis. The test at NASA site on this rocket successfully passed, so that, I think that's a milestone for this for their rocket. They have plans, short-term plans, of launching their rocket, will be called the New Shepard. Actually named that now, and Shepard, the first astronaut to be launched by the United States, and eventually he walked on the moon. Well, the New Shepard is interesting. It's not an orbital spacecraft, but it will be a manned spacecraft. Or unmanned, and, you know, for different experiments. But it's interesting what it does. It takes off, goes into outer space, and when it comes back, the booster comes back and lands vertically. I've seen YouTubes on this thing already. They've had a couple of small successes, a couple of failures, but they're well on their way to achieving this booster. So Blue Origin is the name of this outfit. And long range plans are to have a spacecraft, that's an engineer spacecraft too. And that would be manned, and that would be for orbital. So what they would do is launch the booster spacecraft. The spacecraft would go to orbit, and eventually get them on parachute. But again, the booster would come down and land vertically. And the purpose of that is just making it through. Reuse it over and over again. That's not enough. You have another flight going up in about a month or so from Wallops Island, only about 500 miles from here, down in Virginia. And that's by Orbital Science. This company is not too far behind the heels of SpaceX, which now has a Dragon spacecraft attached to the International Space Station right now as we speak. These people aren't too far behind. In about a month or so, they're going to test the Antares rocket, which is going to be launched from Wallops Island. And put a makeshift spacecraft on top, not an actual spacecraft. They're saving that for probably the end of the year, maybe early 2013. And they're going to put that thing into orbit, bring that to the space station as a demonstration flight, similar to what SpaceX did. And the difference here is this will not be a reusable spacecraft. It will not ever be a manned spacecraft. They already have a contract with NASA for 8 flights to the space station. This is orbital flying. They will be doing this. Their first actual flight to the space station will probably be maybe spring or maybe in the summer of next year. You've got a space race going on, but it's all by corporations. That's pretty much it for now. Any comments or questions? trips to the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity, they saw a bunch of these flecks in the dirt that they were about to pick up from Mars and put into the machine to have it analyzed, and they were afraid the flecks may have been something that chipped off the side of the scoop of the of Curiosity. They were afraid that it was a contamination, so they went and got another scoop, as I remember. And I think they only put a symbol for the dirt inside of Mars' soil inside to be analyzed. And I guess you and I haven't yet read what that analysis showed. And I think one of the major goals of Curiosity is to look for the ingredients that could have sustained life at an earlier time on Mars. And if they were really lucky, they'll even find evidence of the life itself. Now, when it comes to putting a object like the International Space Station at the Earth-Moon Lagrange point number 2 and manning it with human beings, wow. I'm skeptical of that one, Paul. You and I have got some idea of how many years of, how many man years, let me drop. How many man years and how many billions of dollars have gone into putting the International Space Station 260 miles above the surface of the Earth. To launch hardware anything like that in mass and habitability and volume, to launch it into Lagrange point number 2 behind the moon, which is 1 million miles beyond the moon. And the moon's 250,000 miles, so it's a 250,000 miles away from the surface of the Earth. To launch hardware out there with human beings that far, that heavy, compared to the 260 miles above the surface of the Earth. Wow. To put the infrared telescope, I can't think of the name of it, the one that's coming up in about 10 years or so. What's the name of the infrared telescope about to be launched and later this decade, Paul?
That's the James Webb. James Webb Space Telescope.
That's the word I'm looking for. To put James Webb out there, where now he's on the backside of the moon, not looking at the infrared radiation of the Earth, in a nice cold spot in space, in a nice stable orbit, and now making these really beautiful observations. I mean, that James Webb, if it does half of what it's supposed to do, it's going to be equally as popular in my mind as the Hubble Space Telescope. To put a piece of hardware out there makes a lot of sense. To put a human being out there, wow. What does a human being do? I mean, to maintain a human being in space takes a lot of resources. I mean, every month or so, you've got something like a Progress ship going up, bringing a ton or 2 tons of consumable materials, food, oxygen, water, and test equipment every month or so, just to maintain those astronauts on the International Space Station. You've got the tons of stuff being transported back and forth. To do that, not 200 and some odd miles, 250 miles, but to do it 1.25 billion miles in space, to maintain human beings out there, I'm skeptical. This is a good thing to talk about. It's a nice study to do. But to really finance it, how many bangs do you get for that particular dollar, if you know what I mean, Paul? I'm very skeptical about this one. Nice to talk about, good science fiction. And by the way, let me drop this. In all of the earlier science fiction we used to read, the rocket would land on the moon by going there, turning itself around, and landing tail first. Then the rocket would come back to Earth, turn around, and land tail first. It makes very nice science fiction. When you really do that, you're taking all of the fuel and food that you want to come back home, all of the propulsion systems, and landing it on the moon, where most of it doesn't do you any good, then you've got to get it back out of that gravity well-cored moon. I mean, the huge breakthrough of the Apollo program is the invention of the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous Technique,
where only a very small fraction of the vehicle went down to the moon and came back up. To take all of the mass of the rest of the vehicle, bring it all the way down to the moon, slow it down, land it, then bring it all the way back up again is very wasteful. So, to bring a rocket back to Earth and land it tail first takes a lot of extra fuel compared to gliding it down with a wing or with a parachute. On top of that, when you're landing tail first, if that engine hiccups on the way down, you're in a heap of trouble. You're going to crash. And you're going to blast off with the escape pod and everything else gets wasted. So a lot of resources required, a lot of cost, and a lot of risk. I'm a little skeptical about this one also, Paul. So I'm going to send it back to you for a couple of words on this. Why do you want to put a man in Lagrange Point number 2? It's going to take him. Let me pick a number, 100 times more dollars and man hours than it did to put a man into the International Space Station. And you get 100 times more benefit out of doing it. Thank you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, essentially, they want to have people back on the moon. And they would like to have observatories on the moon. Looking out. So we thought that would be a good place to put them on the dark side of the moon. Get them away from radio noise from Earth. So now you need equipment, people. And it would be nice to have, in the beginning, somebody looking down at the surface of that moon and operating the equipment directly from space, almost in real time, you know. They're doing pretty good on Mars with the 20-minute lag time and all, you know. But I mean, if you think about it, with their program, the Mars rovers a day in advance, and then it goes up. Does what it's got to do and comes back. I mean, it's not like they're sitting there real time with that. If you could have somebody sitting in orbit, well, not really orbit, but I mean, if you want to consider it a 30-day orbit, that's what it really would be. Sitting on the dark side of the moon, looking down, and operating equipment from the moon. That would be the early reasoning to have something like that. It's actually a byproduct. The main reason for it would be to practice the long flights to Mars to drop down the asteroids. I mean, that's what this Orion spacecraft is being built for. The Russian companies are picking up the slack for the cargo vessels going up to the space station, and eventually the manned flights going up to the space station. But the Orion spacecraft is being built for deep space. They truly want to send this thing to an asteroid or maybe one of the moons of Mars, even Mars itself. They're going to need plenty of practice. And that's one of the points that they brought up in the article that I read. We dropped it, I got a call.
I have a question for you, suggested.
I recognize, John. Yeah, too. The International Space Station flies at an altitude that is below the Van Allen Belt. And as bad as that Van Allen Belt is, it is a beautiful shield. A hell of a lot of the stuff coming out of the sun doesn't get to that International Space Station. It gets stopped by that Van Allen Belt. A couple of times per year, the sun does what it thinks is a minor event. It burps. To us, it's a major event called coronal mass ejection. A number of times per year, the sun will squirt out billions of pounds of charged particles, sometimes aimed at the Earth, and the stuff comes flying at us at 1 or 2 million miles an hour. So these charged particles, this plasma that sort of burps off the sun, but really comes flying at us like bullets. If you're above the Van Allen Belt during one of those events and all of that high power radiation hits you, you're in a heap of trouble. even underneath the Van Allen belt, with under the shielding of that Van Allen belt, still a couple of times a year when those events occur, the astronauts on the International Space Station will go hide for a couple of hours behind some massive object within the space station, within the International Space Station, to protect them from that radiation. You fly above that Van Allen belt where you no longer have that protection. Wow. And you're going to stay there for any significant length of time. When you look at the resources required to get a man to the moon or to the space station at Lagrange Point number 2, tremendous resources required to get him there. Let me drop.
U.S. on his back, by the way.
Yeah, Paul recognized, and a lot of resources required to get him there. So he's not going to go there for an overnight trip or just for a weekend. He's going to go there for 6 months. And for 6 months, he's now above all of the protection of the Earth. And so all of the stuff flying out of the sun is going to be hitting him full fast, full force. That ain't good. And to my knowledge, there's no good shielding mechanism for something like that that's really been invented yet. John's got a question, so we're going to go over to John for his question, and then we'll go back to Paul. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Oh, very good, dude. Paul, I have a question. Has it been considered, or did they ever talk about putting the consumables in orbit, either around the moon or around the Earth? Because we could put, say, 3 or 4 cargo vessels up there, and then use a very small vehicle to tow it to the moon, to put it in orbit, and use that as a refueling station for the asteroid exploration, or anything like that in the works? Over to you, Dick.
You've got it, Paul.
I've heard stories like that before, you know, especially going to Mars, having actually equipment being sent to Mars, in orbit around Mars, and then coming back. Actually, solar orbit, so it would go around Mars and eventually come back to Earth. Some kind of complicated scheme that they had. And in the meantime, they'd have, you know, waypoints where the spacecraft would meet up with supply vehicles in space. About 20, 30 years ago, I remember reading things like that. These were early proposals. Never heard about anything that, like that since. So, nothing like me on that. I mean, the latest theory would be to take the Orion spacecraft, have it dock with another vehicle, a habitable vehicle, with all the supplies and everything, and boosters, fly it all the way to Mars. And, I mean, there was talk about setting up a factory on Mars, creating fuel before we even get there, so you'd have a pinpoint landing and you'd be able to refuel your spacecraft, take off from Mars, you know, certain ways of saving fuel, living off the land, you might say, live the asteroids or the moons of Mars or even Mars drive. And on an NASA site, when they were talking about this, one of the things they would like to do is have people on board looking down at the dark side of the moon with equipment riding around on the moon and having people operated from space. That's an early proposal. One of the things they'd like to do. We'll see. I mean, we're talking about a long time ago. The earliest flight, manned flight, you could have had was the Orion system in 2014 would be the first flight, and that's going to be just two orbits just to test everything, make sure it works okay. So by the time you get the Space Launch System, the SLS, up and running to launch things to Mars, to the asteroids, you're looking at probably 2018, 2019. If you're looking at a long way off, you've got a long time to hold it. As far as the takeoff and vertical landing boosters, not only did one company, Blue Origin, is thinking about it, definitely they want to do it, they drop it. The owner of SpaceX, I forgot his name now, he says he would consider it a failure if he was unable to actually have a booster take off and land vertically. Demonstration flight, the Delta Clipper is a good one to put. Put a Delta Clipper on YouTube. It's an old thing, probably from maybe the late 80s, that NASA was involved with. They showed you these rockets take off. Incredible. Well, this is a spin-off of all that.
I am guessing we've got some wind up at the repeater site tonight because I'm hearing a fair amount of scratching in the background. Windy nights tend to do that, or nights that have got precipitation because rain is happening. I don't think that's happening tonight. And when it comes to one of the things you mentioned earlier, Paul, of a camera on board the International Space Station aimed at the Earth, that would be a lot of fun. Let me tell you where I experienced that. And that is, I installed my television receive on the satellite receiving system, 1985, and for the next 8 or 10 years, I would watch NASA Select religiously. I better reestablish that system, I gotta repair it. And so, whenever the space shuttle was in orbit, for a significant number of hours every day when the astronauts were sleeping, the camera was, one of the external cameras in the cargo hold, would be aimed at Earth. And so you'd go to NASA Select and you would watch live pictures of what the Earth looks like slowly passing underneath the International Space Station in the space shuttle. Let me drop them. And some of those pictures by my standards are really exciting. I remember one particular night at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got up, turned on the satellite system, watched NASA Select, watched the space shuttle passing over South America, passing over Brazil. And there was a huge thunderstorm going on in Brazil. And the thunderstorm covered most of the country of Brazil. And to watch the lightning flashes over Brazil, top view, is really exciting stuff. And you realize that lightning has got a peculiar characteristic when you look at a whole continent's worth of it simultaneously, or at least a whole country's worth. You would see the lightning occur in bursts, where maybe northern Brazil would have a sudden burst of lightning, and within an extremely small fraction of a second, there would be a coupled burst of lightning in the middle of Brazil, in eastern Brazil, in southern Brazil, in western Brazil. In other words, those lightning bursts seem to be coupled. And I've got at least two interpretations of that. Either, number one, the electromagnetic pulse coming out of the first lightning flash somehow triggered the others because they were just ready to go. That's one possible explanation. Another possible explanation is that one of the triggers that frequently happens with lightning is a great big burst of cosmic rays coming from space. So, do the cosmic rays coming from space hit all of Brazil almost simultaneously? That's possible. Or was it the burst of the first lightning bolt triggering the others? Well, if it was the burst of the first triggering the others, you would see it move like a wave across the country. It didn't do that. I would see a burst in multiple places almost simultaneously. So right now, I'm favoring the burst of cosmic rays hitting the whole darn Earth at once. Let me drop. So that plus watching the astronauts do their maneuvers, watching them communicate with Houston, watching them flying through the International Space Station, watching them conduct their experiments. There's a lot, if you have the slightest interest in science, to watch the astronauts live, or as a quarter of a second old, but you know what I mean, by watching satellite television. It's really nice. So once they establish this camera on the International Space Station, that sounds like a lot of fun to watch, and to do it by an internet connection as opposed to the way I had to do it with a satellite system. What's the best guess as to how soon that's going to be established, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Have a question on your observations, Dick.
Roger, John, go ahead, Paul.
At double.
That's about it. You know, I want to go back to something earlier when we spoke about the L2 position. You're talking about the million-mile distance for James Webb. Yeah, that would be outrageous. But the L2 position for Earth Moon is not a million miles out. The million-mile mark is for the Sun-Earth position. That would be at L2. Sun-Earth. But Earth-Moon is, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's not the one that's a million miles out. It's very close to the Moon, relatively speaking.
Okay, good point, Jim Paul. In the case of the Lagrange points, the two that are most stable, I think, are Lagrange point number 3 and 4. If I had a top view of Earth and Moon, and bear in mind that the Moon goes around the Earth at a given orbit of roughly a 240,000-mile radius between Earth and Moon, and if I swung my compass, the sharp point of the compass is on the Earth, I put the pencil on the Moon, and now swing a circle, which represents the Moon's orbit around the Earth. And if the part of the circle that is 60 degrees ahead of the Moon from the Earth's point of view, so you're drawing a point that's called Lagrange point number 3, and once you draw that Lagrange point number 3, it is equidistant, it's an equilateral triangle between Earth, Moon, and that Lagrange point. So there's one 60 degrees ahead of the Moon at the Moon's orbital distance, and one 60 degrees behind the Moon from the Earth's point of view at orbital distance. Those are the two completely stable Lagrange points. There's another Lagrange point on the opposite side of the Earth. There's another Lagrange point on the opposite side of the... Wait a minute now. There's one between Moon and Earth, and it's closer to the Moon. There's one on the far side of the Moon, on a line straight between Earth and Moon.
And you got it now, then.
Yeah, and those are only quasi-stable. In other words, once you arrive at the right position, there's no longer any gravitational disturbance. But if you drift a little bit in any direction from that point, you tend to drift away from it. You're sort of sitting at the top of a rounded mountain, so to speak, gravity-wise, when in your ask the Lagrange point number one or number two. They're not completely stable. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, you need thrust and stuff to readjust things now and then. But yeah, one is between Moon, Earth, and then Leon, and then three is the opposite side of Earth. In other words, you go Moon, Earth, and then, going right through the Earth. Opposite side would be three, and then four would be, if you were to take a compass and go from the middle of the point middle of the Earth, goes from the Moon all the way around, and that's 63 point, that's L4, and then you find L5, a mirror vision on the other side. Back to this.
That's it. L4 and L5 are completely stable. What makes them less desirable than number 2 that you think is being proposed, Paul? Go ahead.
For some reason, they want this thing, in nowhere's land. They want to look down at the moon from space, the dark side of the moon, operate equipment. This is what they're thinking. This is only a proposal that's coming out like in the last week or so. There's been plenty of even science fiction films about the L4 and L5 positions. They usually use that for moon colonies or space colonies. You would put the space colony up at L4 and 5. They're taking the L2 deck. You want to look down at the dark side of the moon.
Yeah, now twice, Paul, you called it the dark side of the moon. You really mean the back side of the moon. Depending on where the moon is in its orbit, the back side of the moon becomes a full moon, even though you and I on Earth will see a new moon at that time. So there is no dark side, but it is the back side, and I know what you mean. Have they discussed the radiation that comes from the sun periodically? There's no protection on Lagrange point number 2. The International Space Station gets a lot of protection from the Van Allen belt. But when you're at Lagrange 2, between the Earth-Moon system, there is none. So have they addressed radiation protection for the astronauts? WS2N, K2LAW?
Well, that report. It is another report. For instance, they would like to launch people to Mars. One way of cutting back on cosmic rays, you're going to need a million gallons of water to go to Mars. So where are you going to store it? You're going to store it in a wall surrounding the middle part of the spacecraft. So imagine going into a small room in the middle of this big spacecraft. You're on your way to Mars. The alarm goes off. A coronal mass ejection has just occurred. It's 24 hours out. And you're going to go to your panic room. You're going to go into the small room of your spacecraft. And you're surrounded by walls of water that you use for drinking and everything else. And the water will help stop the cosmic radiation. I've read things like that, but nothing regarding the L2 space station story that is in there.
Yeah, the way you protect yourself from radiation is to put a lot of massive material between you and the source of radiation, like lead. And water is nowhere near as heavy as lead, so you don't get as much protection. In the article of the safe room with the water in the walls all around you, did they say roughly how much protection that is, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW? doubt about that. I've seen television programs in which space-oriented, space-minded people have said they would go to Mars if they knew it was a one-way mission and they would never come home. And they knew they would die there. They would still volunteer. I'm a little bit amazed by that, because to put a man on Mars, you're putting him into an extremely cold, barren desert of no air, partial gravity, real cold temperatures, as I said, no air pressure. There's a reddish-looking soil everywhere, bright sun above you, no protection from the atmosphere, from cosmic rays hitting you and whatever. Even growing plants, if you set up a farm under a dome on Mars, the radiation coming from space, I'm a little bit skeptical that all of your plants would grow the way you want them to. And you're also a hell of a lot further away from the sun if you're not getting anywhere near as much sunlight. It's a really tough environment. To send a machine called Curiosity there, beautiful thing to do. To send a human being there with all that's required to maintain that human being. As you guys have heard me say before, let me drop. You take the amount of air, water, and food that you as a human being consume in 1 year. It has the approximate volume of your house and the approximate mass of your house. That much material flows through your body in a year. And it's roughly a 3-year mission. So each of your astronauts needs this tremendous amount of material to sustain life as we know it. Obviously, by all these tons of material being brought up every month to the International Space Station by the Progress vehicles. A high percentage of that is human consumable material. So we take for granted the liter of air you draw in from the atmosphere every breath that you take, and you take, what, 20 of those breaths per minute, thousands of them per day, millions of them per year. It takes a lot to maintain a human being that we take for granted. The Earth supplies all of that. It takes every one of those molecules that comes back out of you, which are identical to the ones that go in total number, and it recycles all of them. To do all of that recycling on a space station, the words roll off the tongue very easily. To really do it is hard. So there's a lot of impediments between here and doing that goal. Anybody with any further questions on the space subject before we leave, Paul? Thank you, Paul, for all this information. Anybody with any further questions, give me a call with us right now. KGYW on the TechNet.
WOK.
BGB.
I heard WL2V. Could that be your call letters? Go a little slower. Give me your call letters, your name, and go ahead with your question. John recognized also. L2V, that's what it was. K2RAW.
Right,
K2RAW.
The call is WO2Z, and the name is Ian. Just a quick question that may have been covered in some part in earlier next, but just a quick question, Dick. Just want to get your opinion on looking to purchase a UPS to put in between the radio. One radio in particular that has an oven oscillator that's, I would assume, is continuously running even when the radio physically, well, not physically, but is turned off. But I was assuming the switch and power supply and the oscillator keeps running at all times. And I recently lost a
curious as to why you think you need a UPS in. And the modern-day non-sine wave UPSs make what's called a stepped sine wave, where the peak voltage is still the same, 167 volts. The average voltage is 120 volts RMS. And so with most power supplies on most things like television set and radio and whatever, everything works pretty well with that step sine wave. Very few things need an absolutely pure sine wave. So I think there's a 90-some-odd% chance that the step sine wave is more than good enough for what you need. And is your motivation for putting the UPS on your radio just to make sure that the oven on the master oscillator never has an interruption? Is that your motivation? In which case, probably there are ways of putting some kind of a rechargeable battery as part of the power supply for that particular oscillator, and depending on how many hours of outage time you want to protect from. So is it only that oscillator you're trying to maintain just to make sure you've got the highest possible accuracy because you want to use in your radio on a frequency measurement test? Is that what's going on, Ian? W-O-2-V, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay. It's really just a radio, and not for testing or anything. But because the switching power supply is always providing some amount of power to the oscillator, and I live in an area. I guess Maryland has either varying voltages and or power outages at times. I was up one night and. I just looked at the cable box and it cycled several times because the power went off and on. I know usually with the power coming back on, there are spikes and all kinds of things on the line. So just figured that might have been the cause of me losing what was a fairly new and somewhat expensive power supply on my computer. And seeing as though the switching power supplies and some of the newer radios can be rather expensive, I just figured I'd like to have something in there since I usually don't turn the power switch on the back of the radio off, so it's always running, that I have something, preventing or protecting it.
The computers, for the power supplies for computers, those power supplies are made as inexpensive as possible, and they are subject to failure, even without glitches from the power company. So did the power company supply the glitch that created the failure of that computer power supply is a darn interesting question. And the radio itself that you want to run on a UPS, and hopefully it's doing the de-glitching for you, you got to be careful now about that. There's a kind of UPS where the line voltage from Con Ed or LIPA is continuously being rectified, continuously going into a battery. The output of the battery is continuously going into the inverter, and the inverter is always feeding the protective piece of equipment. It's an inverter that runs 100% of the time. The good news about that is it thoroughly removes the glitches. The bad news is it has a reliability problem. Whereas the other kind of UPS is that if there is an overvoltage or an undervoltage, it allows a certain number of cycles of the overvoltage or undervoltage before it flips over to the inverter mode. So some of those glitches that you want to protect from are still going to get through, I think. I'm not positive, but you see what I'm worried about. Because it takes a certain length of time. It has to study a certain number of cycles before it makes a decision that, hey, it's time to flip over to the inverter mode. So that's question number one. Do you think you're really going to protect from all of that? And is your radio sometimes going to be used in the transmitter mode? Are you trying to store enough energy in your UPS that you can transmit for a certain length of time? W-O-2-V, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, Dick. W-O-2-Z. Zulu is the last letter on the call sign. And no, we just for receiving purposes, not for transmit.
So your main purpose now is to protect from the glitches. And so I think a ordinary non-100% UPS doesn't really give you as much protection from the glitches as you think. I'll admit that if you had 50 glitches in the world, in a row, it's going to remove the last 45 of them. But I think the first five glitches, the first five cycles or so, I'm not sure how many cycles, but some number of cycles of glitch, I think, get through. Anybody else has got knowledge of UPSs on frequency? Am I wrong on that one? If so, give me a call at us right now. K2LIW on the deck net.
KC2QAQ.
Okay, there's a power supply man from way back. Hey, Glenn, the typical UPS that I buy today, how many cycles of glitch does it let through before it flips over to the inverter mode? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I suppose I know that the typical UPS that's been the most popular one that I'm aware of is like the APC. And those particular ones have a surge suppression, like MOBs inside of them, and they have an EMI filter built inside of them. So there is some suppression associated to the MOBs that are inside and the EMI filter that's inside there. So that does give you a certain amount of protection, but not a tremendous amount. Now the question is, when does the UPS kick over? Typically they'll kick over somewhere around the 10 to 25 milliseconds of power drop. So usually you have to lose a full cycle of AC power. So one of the key things that you really have to understand is how much hold-up time your equipment has, and it's how much of a line cycle can disappear. And you have to, usually a good rule of thumb for a piece of equipment is you need at least somewhere around 15 milliseconds of hold-up time of losing a line cycle for that type of UPS to be effective. K2IW, KC2QIQ. 32
KI.
Hello?
Hey, Glenn.
Hey,
guys. Each cycle of 60 cycles is 16 milliseconds. If I've got to have 50 milliseconds of hold-up time, that's the equivalent of, what, about four or five cycles is one way of looking at it. But maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. Eric, K2EJ, K2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
Hello, that kind of sounds the same to me. Most of the UPSs, from my 150 kVA UPS down to the 3 kVA UPS, take the incoming AC and turn it into DC. And the DC is then turned back into AC. And while the DC is off for you to charge the battery, you know, the brain can do whatever it wants, it don't care. It's making DC from DC. So that kind of a little bit strange to me. Take a while, W, King, Tuesday.
Eric, in your broadcast industry, where you're willing to buy Cadillac equipment, and you're willing to have a UPS run 24 hours a day, because it's continuously in the UPS mode, battery being charged by Con Ed or LIPA, and UPS is making the AC, that's great. If I go to Staples today and buy a UPS, that's not what I'm getting. I'm getting a machine that takes the Con Ed or the LIPA power, pours it straight through to my equipment as the load, and only after some number of fractions of a cycle or cycles of failure, interrupter over voltage, does it then flip into the inverter mode where it starts using its battery. So I think most of the UPSs that Ian is likely to buy are not the kind that you're describing that run what I call 100% of the time. Maybe I'm wrong on that one, Eric. KC2EJ, K2LAW.
KC2QIQ with the comments and information on that.
Are those doing that conversion to AC to DC, DC to AC again?
Eric, first, go ahead, Eric.
Careful, let me put it to you this way. Okay, every PCI I've ever bought, and MT and a few other companies, I've never seen them have a device in them that operates the AC line and then switches over to the inverter. I mean, an easy way for you to determine that is to watch the output as you take the plug from the wall. You'll never even see a glitch or a bump. I mean, the only thing I'm aware of that does that kind of thing are flywheels. That even in that case, if the flywheel is the output of the flywheel still coming out of the dynamo. So I've never seen a UPS that buffers the line. It always turns DC, AC into DC,
and from the battery, and the output of the TCD goes to make AC. And anything, I will not have my server on anything, or my computer on anything that's in that, so that's a new one for me.
I think you're about to find out from Glenn that you've got a Cadillac, and very few of us use Cadillac brand, so to speak, UPSs. Glenn, straighten us out on this one. KCQQIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, Eric, actually, on the contrary, the there are high-end server type, you know, 1 kilowatt and above servers that operate the way that you're talking about. But the typical, you know, APC type of UPS backup that you're going to go down and buy at Staples or at any, you know, typical place where that has computers, Micro Center, and you're going to hook up this UPS. What is really inside of it is an MOV, a small EMI filter, and then after that, basically relay switching. And so when you're plugged into the wall, basically what's happening is the AC goes straight through. There's nothing else, no magic to it whatsoever. Then what happens is they have a very, very inexpensive crossover circuit that detects the line. When the line drops below a certain point, what happens is there's a small, like, oscillator IC and a driver that basically just slams the battery voltage and through a very, very low-frequency transformer up and down, up and down. Basically something that it's 60 cycles, but it looks like a square wave that's coming out of this thing. And basically that's what is your power backup. They're real cheap, they're real dirty, and that's why you're buying this thing for like $50. As a matter of fact, some of the most expensive part in most of these APC units is the battery. Back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I do have some more information about the type of the UPS that Eric is talking about and in more inexpensive ways for an amateur to build one.
Okay, the kind of UPS that has what I'm going to call a transfer relay inside, where it either pours contact power straight through or flips over to the inverter power. If I made the guess that 90% of all the UPSs that are protecting computers on Long Island today, would I be wrong to say that 90% of them are the transfer relay type? KC2QIQ, K2RIW? Right.
What I would suggest, Dick, is probably 90% of the computers on Long Island have no protection at all. They're plugged straight into the wall. Then out of the 10% of people who are using UPSs on their computers, then you'd probably say maybe about a good percent, well, most of anything that's below $100 UPSs. There is a majority of these things are like $89.99 down at Staples and places like that. These are just these little simple switchover types. When you start going into the type that actually have real inverters built into them, they're much, much larger, much heavier units. And they usually start looking larger than the size of your PC. There was like your tower case size type power backups. But there are less expensive ways of doing that function that you can do at home, especially if you want to back up things to like, you know, 500 watts or so. K2NW, KC2QIQ.
Comment. If the inverter was continuously running in the manner in which Eric is telling us, wouldn't I hear a continuous sing and hum out of that inverter, out of that alternator function of the kind that gives me the 100% protection? Wouldn't I hear a continuous singing side out of that? Wouldn't I hear a continuous heat dissipation by those switching transistors? Over to you first, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
No, not really. They are high-frequency switches through high-frequency magnetics. So in other words, you can do the inverter function at like 100 kilohertz, and the better inverters usually do that. So you can get inverters that will do that, and they have UPSs with those high-frequency inverters built in. But the issue is that you still have to have a low-voltage power supply and a battery. So in other words, if you're going to have a 24 or 48-volt battery inside your UPS, you need a full-time 100% duty cycle power supply, keeping that battery in above its charge voltage. So it's always ready to go. So if you lose the AC power, basically now you're running down on the battery. So the key issue is that, let's say if your power supply is 90% efficiency and your inverter is 90% efficiency, and I think that you'll probably imagine that both are going to be less than 90. In cascade mode, you multiply the two efficiencies together and you have 81%. So you're basically throwing away 20% efficiency of your power just due to conversion losses. So that's one of the key reasons. I mean, you can make it very reliable, but that's usually the first reason why you don't want to do it. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, Eric. Eric is the guy who's doing it, and so Eric is living with that inefficiency in order to guarantee that his exciter of his broadcast transmitter is always ready to go. KC2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K2EJ. Let me just say that my 7995 Falcon deployment, which I've had to fix on several occasions because it allows you to design a blow up. No manual relay, don't buffer the power. It's DC, it turns the DC to AC. And it's really got a crap switching supply in it, but it makes a pretty good sound wave. It's got about 2% distortion, which is acceptable for plumbing computer switching supply. It's only 3,000 watts. Let me tell you, the circuitry involved in, say, 150 kVA and a UPS, is going to the bypass mode. When I throw the thing into bypass, that's a real interesting thing. It only makes it switch on the zero crossing. Put a lot of effort into making it switch on your zero crossing, so that way the stuff that's running that will change nothing. And actually, when I went to accept the UPS, that's one of the things. We use a fifth part of a quarter on the output to make it switch in between bypass and online. You might be right about a little 100 watt motor that's really sort of like a turn protector. Gives it 10 minutes on your computer to shut down. It's got the little Ethernet connection to a fellow computer to shut itself down. I can see that, but if you just turn the line of most computers, you put out a little bit of a gap or the voltage fall, say, down to 90 volts, you've got problems. K2RAW, K2EJ.
Hold on a second, Alvin. Eric, the kind of UPS that you're describing, if I wanted to run the computers in my house with that kind of quality, roughly how many dollars and how much volume and how many pounds would I be investing? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat the question. I'm being called.
You're describing a very nine high-quality sine wave output, continuous operating UPS. If I wanted to run the computers in my house from a similar piece of equipment, how many dollars would I invest? How many pounds? How many cubic feet? How big, how heavy, how expensive would it be for me to get the quality that you're describing? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Well, how long do you want it to run? Okay, I'm talking about here that I've points that I've picked. That's 300 watts, and it's got 12 output, 10 value worth of battery in it. I think it'll last, it'll run a computer at 300 watts, or less, maybe about half an hour, or maybe a little bit less than that, which is more than adequate to safely shut your computer down. That's what you want to do. The big guys that I'm talking about, like we run the whole master control office, big sucker, three phase, it'll run the thing for about 3 hours. And the whole idea is that when you get a power failure like that, it gives you plenty of time to get the generators up and running. You can switch here, put over using your generators, and you just have nothing but continuous power coming out. Anyway, the little guys cost like 60 or 80 bucks, and it's a little box. It's not anywhere near as big as your computer. It's maybe 12 inches long or 6 inches wide.
I'm hearing a hell of a lot of differences here between what Glenn is saying and what Eric is saying. Wow. We're going to go to Wes and John in that order. Wes, do you understand what's going on here? I'm having trouble. K2XJN, K2RAW.
Hey, you don't know, I don't understand what is going on here. The last request was if somebody has the question in the subject of space, which there is a number of people who put themselves their space in here and they're patiently waiting for their time. And the question is not in the subject at all, but this is you who actually run the show. So just, you know, let me know whether you're going to pick up any one of the questions of mine, or just, you know, tell me that I'm going to go to bed and talk to you.
I don't know if I can guarantee what you're asking. I know what you're asking.
For fairness, are you the people who booked themselves at the beginning of? And your question was, does anybody have a question related to the space, to the last subject? The question is not related to the subject. It's unexpected interruption to the time deserved to the people who love themselves at the beginning of it, which is for our table. And to the
Leo Disney. Okay, Dick, I withdraw the question, and maybe next week we can pick it up again.
Okay, John, you wanted to make a comment?